Chapter 51. In which all the principal personages think fit to leave Brighton, conducted to the ladies, at the Ship Inn, Dobbin assumed a jovial and rattling manner, which proved that this young officer was becoming a more consummate hypocrite every day of his life. He was trying to hide his own private feelings, first upon seeing Mrs. George Osborne in her new condition, and secondly to mask the apprehensions he entertained, as to the effect which the dismal news brought down by him would certainly have upon her. "It is my opinion, George," he said, "that the French Emperor will be upon us, horse and foot, before 3 weeks are over, and will give the Duke such a dance as shall make the peninsula appear mere child's play. But you need not say that to Mrs. Osborne, you know. There mayn't be any fighting on our side after all, and our business in Belgium may turn out to be a mere military occupation. Many persons think so, and Brussels is full of fine people and ladies of fashion. So it was agreed to represent the duty of the British Army in Belgium in this harmless light to Amelia. This plot being arranged, the hypocritical Dobbin saluted Mrs. George Osborne quite gaily, tried to pay her one or two compliments relative to her new position as a bride, which compliments, it must be confessed, were exceedingly clumsy, and hung fire woefully, and then fell to talking about Brighton, and the sea air, and the gaieties of the place, and the beauties of the road, and the merits of the lightning coach and horses, all in a manner quite incomprehensible to Amelia, and very amusing to Rebecca, who was watching the captain, as indeed she watched everyone near whom she came. Little Amelia, it must be owned, had rather a mean opinion of her husband's friend, Captain Dobbin. He lisped he was very plain and homely looking, and exceedingly awkward and ungainly. She liked him for his attachment to her husband, to be sure there was very little merit in that, and she thought George was most generous and kind in extending his friendship to his brother officer. George had mimicked Dobbin's lisp and queer manners many times to her, though to do him justice, he always spoke most highly of his friend's good qualities. In her little day of triumph, and not knowing him intimately as yet, she made light of honest William, and he knew her opinions of him quite well, and acquiesced in them very humbly. A time came when she knew him better, and changed her notions regarding him, but that was distant as yet. As for Rebecca, Captain Dobbin had not been 2 hours in the lady's company before she understood his secret perfectly. She did not like him, and feared him privately, nor was he very much prepossessed in her favor. He was so honest that her arts and cajoleries did not affect him, and he shrank from her with instinctive repulsion. And, as she was by no means so far superior to her sex as to be above jealousy, she disliked him the more for his adoration of Amelia. Nevertheless, she was very respectful and cordial in her manner towards him. A friend to the Osbornes. A friend to her dearest benefactors. She vowed she should always love him sincerely. She remembered him quite well on the Vauxhall night, as she told Amelia archly, and she made a little fun of him when the two ladies went to dress for dinner. Rawdon Crawley paid scarcely any attention to Dobbin, looking upon him as a good-natured nincompoop and underbred city man. Joes patronized him with much dignity. When George and Dobbin were alone in the latter's room, to which George had followed him, Dobbin took from his desk the letter which he had been charged by Mr. Osborne to deliver to his son. "'Tis not in my father's handwriting," said George, looking rather alarmed. Nor was it. The letter was from Mr. Osborne's lawyer, and to the following effect. Etford Row, May 7, 1815. "Sir, I am commissioned by Mr. Osborne to inform you that he abides by the determination which he before expressed to you, and that in consequence of the marriage which you have been pleased to contract, he ceases to consider you henceforth as a member of his family. This determination is final and irrevocable. Although the monies expended upon you in your minority, and the bills which you have drawn upon him so unsparingly of late years, far exceed in amount the sum to which you are entitled in your own right, being the third part of the fortune of your mother, the late Mrs. Osborne, and which reverted to you at her decease, and to Miss Jane Osborne and Miss Maria Frances Osborne. Yet I am instructed by Mr. Osborne to say that he waives all claim upon your estate, and that the sum of £2,000, 4%, annuities, at the value of the day being your one-third share of the sum of £6,000, shall be paid over to yourself, or your agents upon your receipt for the same, by our obedient servant, Hicks. P. S.S. Mr. Osborne desires me to say, once for all, that he declines to receive any messages, letters, or communications from you on this or any other subject. A pretty way you have managed the affair, said George, looking savagely at William Dobbin. Look there, Dobbin, and he flung over to the latter his parents' letter. A beggar, by Jove, and all in consequence of my D.D. sentimentality. Why couldn't we have waited? A ball might have done for me in the course of the war, and may still, and how will Emmy be bettered by being left a beggar's widow? It was all your doing. You were never easy until you had got me married and ruined. What the deuce am I to do with £2,000? Such a sum won't last 2 years. I've lost 140 to Crawley at cards and billiards since I've been down here. A pretty manager of a man's matters you are, forsooth. There's no denying that the position is a hard one, Dobbin replied, after reading over the letter with a blank countenance. And as you say, it is partly of my making. There are some men who wouldn't mind changing with you, he added, with a bitter smile. How many captains in the regiment have £2,000 to the fore, think you? You must live on your pay till your father relents, and if you die, you leave your wife £100 a year. Do you suppose a man of my habits call live on his pay and £100 a year? George cried out in great anger. Who must be a fool to talk so, Dobbin? How the deuce am I to keep up my position in the world upon such a pitiful pittance? I can't change my habits. I must have my comforts. I wasn't brought up on porridge, like McWhirter, or on potatoes, like old O'Dowd. Do you expect my wife to take in soldiers' washing, or ride after the regiment in a baggage wagon? Well, well, said Dobbin, still good-naturedly, we'll get her a better conveyance. But try and remember that you are only a dethroned prince now, George, my boy, and be quiet whilst the tempest lasts. It won't be for long. Let your name be mentioned in the Gazette, and I'll engage the old father relents towards you. Mentioned in the Gazette? George answered. And in what part of it? Among the killed and wounded returns, and at the top of the list, very likely. Sah! It will be time enough to cry out when we are hurt, Dobbin said. And if anything happens, you know, George, I have got a little, and I am not a marrying man, and I shall not forget my godson in my will, he added, with a smile. Whereupon the dispute ended as many scores of such conversations between Osborne and his friend had concluded previously by the former declaring there was no possibility of being angry with Dobbin long, and forgiving him very generously, after abusing him without cause. I say, Becky, cried Rawdon Crawley out of his dressing room, to his lady, who was attiring herself for dinner in her own chamber. What? Said Becky's shrill voice. She was looking over her shoulder in the glass. As he had put on the neatest and freshest white frock imaginable, and with bare shoulders and a little necklace, and a light blue sash, she looked the image of youthful innocence and girlish happiness. I say, what'll Mrs. O do when O goes out with the regiment? Crawley said, coming into the room, performing a duet on his head with two huge hairbrushes, and looking out from under his hair with admiration on his pretty little wife. I suppose she'll cry her eyes out, Becky answered. S.S. he has been whimpering half a dozen times, at the very notion of it, already to me. You don't care, I suppose? Rawdon said, half angry at his wife's want of feeling. You wretch! Don't you know that I intend to go with you, Becky replied. Besides, you're different. You go as General Tufto's aide-de-camp. We don't belong to the line, Mrs. Crawley said, throwing up her head with an air that so enchanted her husband that he stooped down and kissed it. Rodden, dear, don't you think you'd better get that money from Cupid before he goes? Becky continued, fixing on a killing bow. She called George Osborne Cupid, as he had flattered him about his good looks a score of times already. She watched over him kindly at eker of a night when he would drop into Rodden's quarters for a half hour before bedtime. As he had often called him a horrid dissipated wretch, and threatened to tell Emmy of his wicked ways and naughty extravagant habits. She brought a cigar, and lighted it for him. She knew the effect of that maneuver, having practiced it in former days upon Rodden Crawley. He thought her gay, brisk, arch, distinguee, delightful. In their little drives and dinners, Becky, of course, quite outshone poor Emmy, who remained very mute and timid while Mrs. Crawley and her husband rattled away together, and Captain Crawley and Joe's, after he joined the young married people, gobbled in silence. Emmy's mind somehow misgave her about her friend. Rebecca's wit, spirits, and accomplishments troubled her with a rueful disquiet. They were only a week married, and here was George already suffering ennui, and eager for other society. She trembled for the future. How shall I be a companion for him? She thought, so clever and so brilliant, and I such a humble foolish creature. How noble it was of him to marry me, to give up everything and stoop down to me. I ought to have refused him, only I had not the heart. I ought to have stopped at home, and taken care of poor Papa. And her neglect of her parents, and indeed there was some foundation for this charge which the poor child's uneasy conscience brought against her, was now remembered for the first time, and caused her to blush with humiliation. Oh, thought she, I have been very wicked, and selfish, selfish in forgetting them in their sorrow, selfish in forcing George to marry me. I know I'm not worthy of him, I know he would have been happy without me, and yet I tried to give him up. It is hard when, before 7 days of marriage are over, such thoughts and confessions as these force themselves on a little bride's mind. But so it was, and the night before Dobbin came to join these young people on a fine brilliant moonlight night of May, so warm and balmy that the windows were flung open to the balcony, from which George and Mrs. Crawley were gazing upon the calm ocean spread shining before them, while Rodden and Joe's were engaged at backgammon with an Amelia couched in a great chair quite neglected, and watching both these parties, felt a despair and remorse such as were bitter companions for that tender lonely soul. Scarce a week was past, and it was come to this. The future, had she regarded it, offered a dismal prospect. But Emmy was too shy, so to speak, to look to that, and embark alone on that wide sea, and unfit to navigate it without a guide and protector. I know Miss Smith has a mean opinion of her. But how many, my dear madam, are endowed with your prodigious strength of mind? Gad, what a fine night, and how bright the moon is, George said, with a puff of his cigar, which went soaring up skywards. How delicious they smell in the open air. I adore them. Who'd think the moon was 236,847 miles off? Becky added, gazing at that orb with a smile. SN'T it clever of me to remember that? Pooh! We learned it all at Miss Pinkerton's. How calm the sea is, and how clear everything. I declare I can almost see the coast of France. And her bright green eyes streamed out, and shot into the night, as if they could see through it. Do you know what I intend to do one morning? She said. I find I can swim beautifully, and some day, when my Aunt Crawley's companion old Briggs, you know you remember her, that hook-nosed woman, with the long wisps of hair, when Briggs goes out to bathe, I intend to dive under her awning, and insist on a reconciliation in the water. Isn't that a stratagem? George burst out laughing at the idea of this aquatic meeting. What's the row there, you two? Rodden shouted out, rattling the box. Amelia was making a fool of herself in an absurd, hysterical manner, and retired to her own room to whimper in private. Our history is destined in this chapter to go backwards and forwards in a very irresolute manner seemingly, and having conducted our story to tomorrow presently, we shall immediately again have occasion to step back to yesterday, so that the whole of the tale may get a hearing. As you behold at Her Majesty's drawing room, the ambassadors and high dignitaries' carriages whisk off from a private door, while Captain Jones' ladies are waiting for their fly. As you see in the Secretary of the Treasury's antecomer, a half dozen of petitioners waiting patiently for their audience, and called out one by one, when suddenly an Irish member or some eminent personage enters the apartment, and instantly walks into Mr. Undersecretary over the heads of all the people present. So in the conduct of a tale, the romancer is obliged to exercise this most partial sort of justice. Although all the little incidents must be heard, yet they must be put off when the great events make their appearance. And surely such a circumstance as that which brought Dobbin to Brighton, viz. The ordering out of the guards and the line to Belgium, and the mustering of the allied armies in that country under the command of His Grace the Duke of Wellington, such a dignified circumstance as that, I say, was entitled to the pause over all minor occurrences whereof this history is composed mainly, and hence a little trifling disarrangement and disorder was excusable and becoming. We have only now advanced in time so far beyond chapter 22. As to have got our various characters up into their dressing rooms before the dinner, which took place as usual on the day of Dobbin's arrival. George was too humane, or too much occupied with the tie of his neckcloth, to convey at once all the news to Amelia which his comrade had brought with him from London. He came into her room, however, holding the attorney's letter in his hand, and with so solemn and important an air that his wife, always ingeniously on the watch for calamity, thought the worst was about to befall, and running up to her husband, besought her dearest George to tell her everything he was ordered abroad. There would be a battle next week, she knew there would. Dearest George parried the question about foreign service, and with a melancholy shake of the head said, "No, Emmy, it isn't that. It's not myself I care about. It's you. I have had bad news from my father. He refuses any communication with me. He has flung us off, and leaves us to poverty. I can rough it well enough, but you, my dear, how will you bear it? Read here." And he handed her over the letter. Amelia, with a look of tender alarm in her eyes, listened to her noble hero as he uttered the above generous sentiments, and sitting down on the bed, read the letter which George gave her with such a pompous martyr-like air. Her face cleared up as she read the document, however. The idea of sharing poverty and privation in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.